Comer tarta de humildad. Vaughan Town te dará primero un rudo despertar y conforme pasan los días, un nuevo despertar. Un despertar lleno de seguridad, confianza y convicción. Si existen los milagros, Vaughan Town se cuenta entre ellos.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughan Radio. Now, this program is going to be the continuation of an earlier program in which I was talking about the history of Mexico. Mexico from the time of its independence through the time of what we call the Mexican-American War and the aftermath of that war. The coming together, the definitive banishment of Antonio López de Santa Anna, who kept turning up like a bad penny again and again in Mexican history, and finally gone once and for all. And the advent of Benito Juárez. And so, Benito Juárez, I mentioned on my last program, a full-blooded Zapotec, and spoke the language principally into his teens. Right, Spanish was his second language, and he only really learned it in his teens, learned it fluently, learned it eloquently. By then, he could speak Latin as well. He was educated by members of the church who saw his talent. At least initially, he was a shepherd, right? Pastor, as a boy. But quickly, people understood that he was destined for greater things. In any case, he had a law practice. He became a lawyer, had a law practice, and curiously, one of the clerks in his law office, bufete, law office, or law firm, one of the clerks in his firm was a young Porfirio Díaz, sort of a protégé. They knew each other from way back. Both, of course, from Oaxaca. In any case, Díaz and Benito Juárez, I mean, the two most important men in the second half of the 19th century in Mexico. One of them approaching politics through law and this idea of being impartial with self-discipline. This, of course, is Juárez, right? Being sort of implacable, being stoic, being able to think coldly, and not letting his passions get away with him, being able to see the big picture, everything that jurisprudence demands. And so, yes, he became president because he was the leading justice on the Supreme Court. And when the standing president, Comonfort, was ousted, put into exile, he took over. But then, of course, he was forced to leave as well. He came back. He won an election and did become president. In any case, he largely responsible, were he and Lerdo and a few others, largely responsible for the Constitution of 1857. In that Constitution, all privilege means private law. That's literally what it means. Some people have the public law and others have a private law. Private law, privilege. And there were privileges for members of the clergy, for church property, for all sorts of things. They didn't have to obey. They obeyed their own laws. You can imagine, you annoy a member of the church, a member of the clergy. You can imagine the potential for abuse. You can break a law you've never heard of and be tried and convicted by a church court. And the same was true of the army. The army had its privileges and its capacity for abuse. So yes, you would go to a military court if you did something they didn't like, or if you broke a law you had no idea existed, because it's not part of the general law. In any case, all privileges for the clergy and the army disappear. You know, in these traditional societies, you have, it's very curious, very, very curious, and this was true in Spain until relatively recently. You have very little social mobility. If you are born poor, you stay poor. If you're born rich, you stay rich. And so the middle class, the growing middle class, that gives you some possibility for rising in your station or falling, but not much. You're never going to be among the aristocrats. You're never going to be among the poor, the real poor. And they stay in their position. Well, so these class definitions are fixed. As I say, very little social mobility. And the entire society, let's call it this pyramid, this entire society is kept in place by a framework, right? Una moldura, un marco, a framework of the church and of the military. Now, the ironic thing there is that the church and the military are both relatively meritocracies. They are amenable. Somebody can start from nothing in those institutions and rise pretty high out of merit. So yes, this is the paradox that these are two relative meritocracies that absolutely prevent meritocracy in the larger society. Now, the money from the church was used to finance the War of the Conservatives. So yes, the archbishop gave his permission to melt down the gold and the silver in sacramental objects, religious objects in the church, as a way to finance this war. In addition to which, loans, massive loans, were taken out in Europe by banking families and others that believed in absolutism, aristocracy, that liberalism had to be stopped at any cost. So yes, these were contributing to the conservative side. Whereas Juarez turned to the United States. He gave the United States access to the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, sort of in the time before the Panama Canal, before anybody ever considered a Panama Canal, this narrow area, you know, just sort of north of Yucatan, this narrow cross was a very good way to get things from the Atlantic to the Pacific and vice versa. And so the Americans were given extraordinary war rights in Tehuantepec. Yes, this was a gesture of goodwill because nobody believed that treaty was going to be ratified, and it was not ratified. The American Congress never, well, this was at a time just before the American Civil War. And Abraham Lincoln in office was not an expansionist, would not have wanted it, would have rejected it. And people knew he was going to win. He was not even on the ballot in the South. And so you had Frederick Douglass and other, you had other people running, but they had no chance of winning. And immediately, as soon as Lincoln became president, because Lincoln was completely rejected in the South, the South as a whole saying, this man is not my president. And South Carolina, which had always been the first to believe that it had more autonomy and independence than, even though it formed part of the Union, it really didn't, and that a confederacy would be much better than federated states. In South Carolina, they shot at an American, a federal installation at a fort, Fort Sumter, there in Charleston Harbor. And that was the beginning of a civil war, which was going to mean that the United States could not in any way participate in what was coming next. So yes, in this case, Juarez is considered a traitor for having signed this agreement, giving the Americans access to Tehuantepec. But obviously it was never going to happen. Again, Benito Juarez is absolutely revered in Mexico as the father of the country. There are something like 4,500, if I remember, 4,516 streets in Mexico named after him. So you can imagine the number of plazas, the number of schools. Everything is Juarez there. And of course, Ciudad Juarez. But again, people say, oh yes, well, this was one of the shameful things he did. Well, not really. Not really. Anyway, as I mentioned in the previous program, during the time of this war, there was absolutely no money, and no money to pay the interest on the debt. And so they suspended payments. They didn't renounce the debt. They suspended payments, but this was enough. You had the French, Spanish, and English coming to Veracruz in an invasion. And so they took possession of Veracruz with no resistance being offered. And then went, because I think I mentioned on an earlier program that Veracruz was not a nice place at that time. It was a port city. It was a sort of tropical port city, Caribbean, subtropical, but a place of malaria, of yellow fever. Well, very much actually like Cádiz at the time, but still, Orizaba was considered much nicer. And there, the commissioners had an interview with President Juarez. Now, he assured them that Mexico recognized these debts and that they would be paid in good time, and that was enough for England and Spain. England and Spain at this time suspected that France had an ulterior motive. And so, yes, General Prim, who was in charge at that time of the Spanish delegation, Prim simply left. Now, Napoleon III of, he was extraordinarily ambitious, and he got mixed up in everything, everything going on at that time, Algeria and the Crimean War, and the liberation of Italy, the Risorgimento, everything he could. And he decided that he was going to rival his great uncle, Napoleon I, in military fame. And it was going to be now or never, because the United States at this time was absolutely tied up in the war, in the Civil War. There was no way that they could enforce, right, to enforce, hacer cumplir. There was no way that they could enforce the provisions of the Monroe Doctrine. And so, yes, Napoleon had looked around. Obviously, there were many refugees from among the conservatives in Paris at that time, conspiring, trying to get a word in his ear, trying to talk. And it was, if I remember correctly, Napoleon III's wife was Eugenia de Montijo. In any case, that was their access. And, well, there was a conspiracy to overthrow the Juarez government and to put somebody on the throne. Now, who? Well, perhaps the younger brother of the Austrian emperor. The Austrian Empire, soon to be the Austro-Hungarian Empire, there's going to be a big rupture in a couple of years, but still, at the beginning of the 1860s, it was still the Austrian Empire. The younger brother of the emperor himself in Trieste. He and his wife, Carlotta, wanting something to do. And yes, they were considered the apt couple, Maximilian Joseph. And he allowed himself to be halagado, no, flattered. He tickled his vanity that Napoleon III would want to make him emperor of Mexico, put him on the throne with money and troops from France. And of course, members of the clergy and the aristocracy in Mexico, there in Paris, told him that there was no way he could lose. So this is what happened. Napoleon, obviously not working for the advantage of Austria, not really working for the advantage of France that much. I'm not really sure. The glory, of course, was all going to go to him. He was going to be a kingmaker, right? An emperor maker. I suppose a little like Napoleon Bonaparte, a little like his great uncle, he liked to move pieces on a chessboard, on a grand scale, and put new lines in maps and create new countries, and that must have been his purpose on earth. Well, Napoleon III. The French troops stayed in Orizaba. It was going to be very, very difficult to get them out. They began to march towards Puebla, and they were joined by troops from the conservative faction who had risen in their support. Now, Juarez, trying to enlist troops, trying to get people to participate, the way they hadn't participated when the Americans invaded. Well, this was equally difficult, but, there was a general, Zaragoza was his name. General Zaragoza, with about 2,000 men, set himself up in Puebla and the hills around Puebla, and succeeded. In this, he was helped by General Porfirio Díaz. No, he wasn't a general at that point, but in any case, Porfirio Díaz, who, by the way, was the same age as Zaragoza, I think, at this time, something like in his early 30s. Very, very young men, both of them. But they were largely responsible. Díaz was completely insubordinate and didn't listen to orders, did what he wanted, but it worked. And so Zaragoza did not discipline him. In any case, the French weren't expecting this. The French were not expecting the Mexicans to fight this way, a way they had not fought when the United States was attacking. And the fact that they were vigorously repulsed surprised everybody. The defense of Puebla took place on the 5th of May. That means that until this day, the 5th of May is the great celebration in Mexico. Everybody thinks Cinco de Mayo. What is the Cinco de Mayo? Cinco de Mayo is not their Independence Day. Cinco de Mayo is not the celebration of anything more than the effective defense of Puebla. But because Puebla had been defended, it was going to take about a year there. The French are going to regroup, go back to Orizaba, and it will take them a long time to really get the troops in. You know, with Algerians as well, right? Zouave troops and so forth. They're going to move in eventually, but the defense of Puebla will cost them precious time, and it meant, you know, that Maximilian capitulated in Querétaro, but the war was won in Puebla. Now, the French in Orizaba found themselves in this situation of, you know, several thousand Mexicans on a hill overlooking the town, and it was easy for them to bombard the French, cut off the supply of food, etc., etc. The officer, French officer, observed that the Mexican women went up a very steep path, sendero, to the top of the hill carrying water on their heads for the use of the troops. So he got permission to send 150 of his men up this path, and they reached the summit, they reached the top, and nobody had seen them. The 150 men, he began to cry, "A moi, no, les Zouaves, la Légion," and And after that, the Mexicans were dislodged. The French could stay in Orizaba, but again, they had lost a lot of precious time. After that, the reinforcements came, increasing the men to something like 50,000, 40 or 50,000, plus the clerical party, the conservative party. And they attacked Puebla again. This time it was a Marshal Bazaine who led the French. And although the defense was obstinate, they made it, and they pushed through to Mexico City. Juarez had to retreat, this time to San Luis Potosí, which became the head of government. And, all right, I have to take a break. I'll be back in a minute.
Escuchando Vaughn Radio.
You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
Vaughan Radio.
Entra en grupobaugan.com y visita nuestra tienda. Descubre expresiones en inglés que deberías conocer o los tres volúmenes de Vocabulario Vaughan. Tres libros de vocabulario por temas con 1100 palabras cada uno. Y por supuesto, aprende inglés desde cero. Descubre todo el material disponible de Vaughan en grupobaugan.com y entra en la sección de Vaughan Tienda. Envío gratis.
Ven a hacer tu prueba de nivel. Sin compromiso, tu prueba de nivel gratis. Llámanos 911-335833.
In the professional world, effective communication is everything. Even the most technically inclined engineers need to be good communicators if they want to move up in their profession. This applies not only to good communication skills in Spanish, but in English as well. To be effective in English, you need to achieve a level C2 in listening comprehension and C1 plus in speaking. In other words, you need to be able to understand perfectly meanings and nuances in real time. In the real world, subtitles are not available. Many people in Spain believe that their English proficiency is sufficient. This is not true. To understand me or to understand your English teacher is easy. However, understanding lawyers, engineers, doctors, business managers, and other professionals is not easy. It is extremely difficult and requires at least 2 years living and working in an English-speaking country. Until you reach a close to perfect ability to understand native speakers in their native environment, you can consider your level of English to be deficient. Second, until you are able to reproduce orally basic English grammar with agility and spontaneity, your speaking ability will betray you. You will feel the frustration of losing communication power when you change from Spanish to English. Don't underestimate the power of a strong command of English. In the real world, in the professional world, it is much more conclusive and decisive than an MBA or any other graduate degree. I hope you agree with me. My conviction concerning this subject is the result of 45 years learning Spanish and French, teaching English, and observing personally the struggles, the victories, and the failures of more than 2,000 Spanish people. This is the reason why I designed, 20 years ago, the Master in Professional English. This master will take you a long way towards achieving the ultimate goal, mastery of English. It will transform you into an effective communicator. It will eradicate your invertebrate English and infuse you with structure and fluency. And most importantly, it will give you the listening comprehension ability that is so essential to feeling free and empowered in your speech. The Master in Professional English. Vaughan.
Déjate de excusas, déjate de miedos, de vergüenza. Ven a vernos, ven a conocernos, ven a hacer tu prueba de nivel. Sin compromiso, tu prueba de nivel gratis. Llámanos 911-33-5833. 911-33-5833.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughn Radio. Now, on the first part of the program, I was talking about what happened in Mexico before the arrival of Emperor Maximilian. And all of this that I mentioned, all of the battles and all of the, you know, the French trying to establish themselves, being dislodged, almost being kicked out of Orizaba, sent back to Veracruz. Well, all of this happened before the reinforcements and before Maximilian himself arrived. Well, he came to Veracruz and was greeted with enthusiasm. They immediately treated him like the emperor he was, especially by members of the church. They had told the Indians that they could expect from him that finally that their liberties would be back, right? You can never trust a liberal. Liberty, the only possible liberty is through absolutism. In any case, he was met with welcome. He was young, and he was there with Carlota, his young bride. And you can imagine they were given a special reception, and the creme de la creme, the florinata of Mexican society was there to welcome them. You know, everybody became a monarchist. Everybody became an imperialist. And the castle of Chapultepec, which you remember previously, had been a military academy. Now it was fitted out as their summer residence. Later on, it's going to be the official residence. It's going to be the place the king lived. Of course, today, it is a museum. But before that, it was the palace. And then the presidential residence. Now, Maximilian, again, from Trieste. That's the northern part of the Adriatic Sea. That's today it's just, you know, on the border between Italy and Slovenia. And it's a place, it's an amazing place. This is where Germanic culture, Romance culture, and Slavic culture come together. And Trieste in its day was a cosmopolitan European capital. The center of everything. Subsequently, especially after the First World War, it became sort of lost, abandoned. During the Cold War, it was where the Iron Curtain ended, and so it is a little desolate even today. But still, you can look at it and see that the past was glorious. Now, by nature, Maximilian was a dreamer. And by nature, he believed that he was going to be the emperor, you know, by the grace of God, the emperor of all the Mexicans, which made him much more partial to the liberal ideas than to the conservative ones. And so, in a sense, he shot himself in the foot, right? He cut off his own leg by turning his back on his supporters, who wanted him to be much more authoritarian, much more imperious, much more absolutist than he really was. He firmly believed that Benito Juarez was the kind of man that you could do business with, but asked Juarez on several occasions to negotiate and to work with him for a better Mexico. Well, he acted as though Mexico was still sort of in a colonial way, right? That the 19th century hadn't even happened yet. That it was primitive. And this kind of paternalism, well-meaning paternalism, but nevertheless, a kind of disregard for the situation as it really is. So, the negotiation for loans in Paris and London had supplied him with plenty of money, and it looked for a while as if he were going to win, because Juarez, again, still calling himself president of Mexico, isolated in the north, in the field, taking refuge. Well, Maximilian obviously believed that resistance was futile, that his domination, his the adulation of his people was growing daily. Now, the fact is that because it had taken him so long to establish himself, at first, the French had been there for a long time, and the French had been defeated at Puebla, and then Maximilian had taken his time to come. Now, all of this meant that by now, the Civil War in the United States was over, and President Lincoln, and subsequently President Johnson, they expressed their displeasure to the French in no uncertain terms. Washington, D.C., told, gave them an ultimatum, basically. And Louis Napoleon was going to have to withdraw his troops or answer to the United States. Meanwhile, American veterans of the Union Army were massing along the border, in part to keep out the Confederate adventurers. Remember, after the Confederates lost the war, they still believed that they could regroup someplace. Some of them became filibusteros and tried to set themselves up in South America. Tried to carve out territory and, become autonomous in South America. If any of that had been successful, then it would have attracted many, many more people. And so there were Union soldiers. Remember that the Union soldiers had been there from the very beginning. On an earlier program, I talked about the importance of Galveston, Texas, and of New Orleans, strategically speaking. Well, from the very beginning of the American Civil War, Galveston and New Orleans were occupied by the Union. Made it impossible for the Confederacy to prosper. Now, here they were trying to keep Confederate soldiers out, and as a show of strength for the French. So, yeah. The French dictator left the National Army, which Bazaine had organized. Was not going to resist. Without French help, the whole thing was going to collapse like a house of cards. Maximilian wanted to sign a decree of abdication, but Carlota was ambitious. And there are many who say that she personally was responsible. On the other hand, they were retreating. They were going back. And while they were near the coast, right, in Puebla, they met General Miguel Miramón, who was just coming from Europe. And there are other people that say it was Miramón who convinced them, or convinced Maximilian, to stay. Miramón had been a religious fanatic from the very, very beginning, and could not understand why anyone would attack the Catholic Church. It's like attacking God. He saw things in terms of black and white. For example, for him, there were no non-combatants. You know, anybody who isn't actively for us is against us. And so people who surrender or people, innocent people who are non-combatants, their lives don't mean a thing. Right? If they have sold their souls to the devil already, their lives don't mean a thing. In this case, he earned the nickname El Joven Macabeo, right? The Young Maccabee. And again, he fought. He rejected all kinds of compromises. He was perhaps the bloodiest general in the Guerra de Reformas. He was in exile. He was in Rome for a good part of this. He went to Cuba, he went to Rome, and finally the Archbishop asked him to return from his exile to help Maximilian's empire. Now, Miramón did not like Maximilian, and certainly did not like the fact that Maximilian had expressed views that were very, very close to the views of liberals. You know, what is the point? Well, he convinced Maximilian to stay, that it was his duty to stay. He and Carlota both. And so they made that one last stand. Maximilian must have thought that Miramón was very dangerous because he sent him to Europe, sent him to Prussia. Why Prussia? Prussia, you know, during... Prussia is the heart of Lutheranism, and it must have been really bad for him. He was sent to Prussia without any money. He was Mexico's representative, and that usually requires a lot of public relations and trying to, you know, put your best foot forward and making a, you know, presentable. You know, this is not, and if he is in any way Chabacano. Right? Dowdy, or if he is shabby in any way, if he makes a poor spectacle of himself, then Mexico itself is humiliated. In any case, he went back. He joined the emperor at the last stand in Querétaro and was shot. You know, one of the people shot there. It was Benito Juárez who was debating the pros and the cons, because from all over the world, you had messages, telegrams, people, don't shoot Maximilian. He's the brother of the Emperor of Austria, and all this sort of thing. And evidently, Juárez was debating in his own mind the pros and cons of all of this when Lerdo de Tejada, his trusty advisor, Lerdo said, ahora o nunca se salva la patria. Right? Now or never you save your country. And that was enough. They were killed. And this gave Mexico a very, very bad reputation as being, you know, bloodthirsty and savage, right? Bronco. Again, as a dissuasive tool, as a pedagogical tool, it was very, very effective. Because nobody ever tried anything even remotely like that. Again. So yeah, Díaz, Porfirio Díaz, had captured the city of Oaxaca and marched to Puebla, captured Puebla, a place he knew well, and then to Mexico City itself. Yeah, the Miramón again. Miramón and Mejía were taken, were shot, and that was it. The last words evidently were, "May my blood be spilt." This was Maximilian. May my blood be spilled for the welfare of the country. And if I should shed, may it flow for its good and not by treason. Long live independence. Long live Mexico. All of this patriotic sentiment, a Mexican patriotic sentiment that seemed very out of place for somebody who had, you know, determined to be an enemy of the people. So, yeah, Benito Juárez came back. Guadalupe Victoria was president, and Juárez came back. He wanted to stay in office longer than he should have. And this is going to be a constant, you know, because after him it's going to be Díaz who stays in office for 34 years. But then, after that, other people are trying. Let's see, Obregón, Calles, people who should have known better. They want to stay in office, and well, Juárez died in office, died peacefully, and this was. Is one of the reasons he is revered. Now, the next person we have to talk about is precisely Porfirio Díaz. He was the son of an innkeeper, right? An inn, a posada, a place to sleep. And, again, from Oaxaca, just like Juárez, he had he had something like, on his mother's side, he was one quarter Indian. So yes, he had Indian blood, but not 100%, not like Juarez. He was 3 years old when his father died. And that was a great tragedy. His mother had six children. And Porfirio was educated to enter into the church. She wanted him going as a seminary student so that he could ultimately be a priest. But of course, that was completely alien to his disposition, and so he very quickly rejected it. Now, when the war began between Mexico and the United States, the law students there in Oaxaca, because that's what he wanted to be, he wanted to study law. Jurisprudence was his thing, but the law students got together to form a military battalion. And so in the world, you know, in that sort of, revolving door between military and politics, between law and politics, Díaz is going to spend more time in the military than with the law, although he was a good law student. Well, he went, and I spoke about him, in the defense of Puebla, working under General Zaragoza. That victory in the Cinco de Mayo was in large part because of his courage and ability. Now, he was captured, I think, twice at Puebla, and both times he escaped. Yep. He was extremely popular, and when he walked into a room, he had this kind of magnetism, this electricity, this charisma that... In the United States, politicians talk about working a crowd, right? El baño de multitudes, de masas, and you can come in and shake enough hands. And by the time you're done, the room itself will be eating out of your hand, right? This charm, you turn on the charm. Those people who have it, those people who understand it, are among the luckiest people in the world. And, well, Díaz, again, 32, made a brigadier general because, yes, before the Battle of Puebla, yes, he was a general at that time. And at that point, he probably could have won a free and fair election. Probably could have beat Juarez, because he was everything Juarez was not. Juarez was distant. Juarez was, again, implacable, a sort of unemotional, and he inspired admiration, but not love. We can put it that way. Whereas Porfirio Díaz was very seductive in his power. And he waited. He waited until Juarez, as I say, died in office, sort of extended his presidency longer than he should have, but still died in office. And when he was dead, Díaz came back from Oaxaca, and, well, it was going to be pretty much for good this time. When he did become president, he was going to stay in power for a total of 34 years. There were many, many people who had been born and had never known another president. So yes, Diaz was absolutely formidable. And during this time, Mexico was at peace and the economy was growing, but at the price of a great deal of brutality, especially, well, against the poor. Lots and lots of exploitation going on during this time. But I'll have to talk about that on another program because I have run out of time.
Déjate de excusas, déjate de miedos, de vergüenza, ven a vernos, ven a conocernos, ven a hacer tu prueba de nivel, sin compromiso, tu prueba de nivel gratis. Llámanos 911-33-5833, 911-33-5833.
Estás escuchando Bon Radio.
¿Crees que tienes un buen nivel de inglés? Vete a Vaughan Town y date cuenta, nada más llegar, que tu dominio es más cercano al cero absoluto. En inglés se dice humble pie, o sea, comer tarta de humildad. Vaughan Town te dará primero un rudo despertar y conforme pasan los días, un nuevo despertar. Un despertar lleno de seguridad, confianza y convicción.